Bienvenue à la 98e episode de Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
We've been reasonably confident in claiming to be the only interhemispherical cricket podcast. We're now a little bit more confident that we are, certainly for the moment, the only French-Australian cricket podcast.
So it's here in Sydney, it's 7:50 a.m. on Thursday morning, the sun is up, there are probably people in lycra eating avocado toast outside, it's probably about 25 degrees, you're in Paris, it's 10 o'clock at night on a Wednesday night, there's snow lying on the ground, I believe,
and the most remarkable thing is...
Thick, proper snow. The most remarkable thing is your glorious French accent. I never actually really had you down as an international man. And when you announced you were moving to Paris, this is something that had me a bit worried. But you're obviously ingratiating yourself with the locals.
Well, I've actually been informed that I'm at a disadvantage accent-wise because my French teacher has told me that...
Because your accent's appalling.
My accent is appalling, but I have an excuse for it, which is that apparently the English people with the best accents are northerners, and as a southerner, I am therefore disadvantaged right from the start, so it's not my fault.
Just another reason that London is not the place to live, and we're glad that you're out of there. So obviously this podcast started between kind of London and Cambridge almost 100 episodes ago. It's now between Sydney and Paris. Look how life moves on. Now, obviously, one of the biggest issues for you, Andy, is going to be when it actually comes to playing cricket when this summer, when this European summer rolls around. We often tout the fact that, of course, France are the silver medal winners at the Olympic Games, the current silver medal winners at the Olympic Games in cricket, having played in the only game of the only time cricket ever appeared at the Olympic Games. Do you see that tradition continuing in the streets around you? Do you walk outside and get your hat knocked off by a cricket ball?
I'm yet to see any evidence of cricket in Paris, although I have been told there are some beautiful chateau grounds, which I hope to pay a visit to.
Oh, I bet they are. Yeah. But
yeah, I will admit to of having had a slight pang when I saw the Pinckney's Green Cricket Club messages going around for the start of winter nets. Because, you know, for all of us who've spent too much of our lives playing cricket, it becomes a very important marker of the seasons. And that moment where winter nets arrives, you're kind of like, oh, summer is on the horizon, winter will finally end.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be the first summer in a while I haven't played cricket. I was trying to work it out the other day. It's certainly the first in maybe 7 or 8 years, possibly even a little more. And I'm curious and a little bit excited, actually, about finding what on earth I'll do with sort of 10 to 14 extra summer Sundays. I'm also kind of pretty curious to find out what it is that I'll miss. So will I miss the game itself? You know, will I miss those long afternoons chasing the ball hopelessly to the boundary and, you know, the endless low scores interspersed by the odd moment of glory? Or will I actually basically just miss Pinckney's Green on a sunny day and miss my teammates? Which I must admit, my suspicion is that it'll be more of the latter. There's also kind of this question, as I'm fascinated how much I'll miss it. I've got a very good friend who had acted for years and years, and she at one point took a year off acting just to find out, did she miss it, or did she actually just do it out of habit? In her case, she found out she very much missed it. But I think it's an interesting experiment once in a while to sort of take yourself away from the things you obsess over.
What's interesting in your case is that often when people move from one country to another, doing something like playing cricket or joining a sports team is actually the way that people get to meet people in the first instance. You know, the way that you might get to meet like-minded people who also have a nerdy love of cricket statistics to the level that you do. And so, you know, in a way, moving somewhere where there's no cricket at all is a bit of a I don't want to say a missed opportunity, but you know what I mean. Certainly when I moved to Australia, I met a whole lot of people by playing cricket and by going into that environment. So for me, I never stopped playing, but I also don't really miss cricket in the UK in quite the same way as you might. Would you ever nip back to the UK for a weekend in the summer to make a guest appearance at Pinckney's Green?
Yeah, well, this has already been raised. I would certainly, I think I'll inevitably do it at one point. I'm just, I'm that sad that I think I will inevitably do it. I was very hopeful that there might be a tour, which would always be a great excuse to a great excuse to pop back. But no, you're absolutely right about the sport. And I mean, I've done it actually with the other things I do in terms of like running and football, where it has been a good way to sort of meet people. But I think in this case, it will actually be quite interesting because of the effect that cricket has, I think, particularly on that one season, on that one period of summer, where it's such a big part of the routine. And I think it'd be really interesting to sort of have the summer without that bit of the routine. I did also think that having dragged my partner sort of over here, sort of saying that every Sunday
disappearing for a whole weekend,
exactly. Maybe less acceptable than it is in the UK, because of course in the UK it's entirely acceptable.
Exactly, and you would say you used to lose me just for Sundays. You're going to lose me for the Saturday and Monday as well for the travel time on either side. No, that possibly wouldn't go down quite so well. It's interesting. I mean, I've had this summer for me here in Australia has probably been the most steeped in cricket summer I think I've ever had in my life, one way or other. I've been playing a lot. I've got to get this in somehow. I actually got my highest ever score with the bat, a cheeky 82 not out off 30 balls, which I wanted to mention on the podcast because I'm particularly proud of it and it's never going to happen again.
That is so one hell of a strike rate. Right?
Also with the England team being over here, I've been going to a lot of games. I'll talk a bit about that later as well. The other thing that I've just got into the groove of, one way or other, is following other cricket that's been going on around the world in a closer way than sometimes I do. Usually I sort of dip in and dip out. And the thing that really had sort of caught my eye was the drama of that India-South Africa test series, and particularly that third test, which kind of caught my eye as much as anything because it was happening just as the Ashes were drawing to a close, and so usually my attention would have been very much on the Ashes, but suddenly there was a much more compelling game happening elsewhere. And also because of the fact that it was one of those games that I reckon, if we were still podcasting in 75 years' time, which, you know, we may well be, we would actually be featuring in from the archives and, you know, digging out the scorecard and saying, wow, look at this game. Isn't this amazing? And of course, this was the series where India were visiting South Africa, India away from home in South Africa. They're 2-0 down. They've lost the first. They've sort of capitulated a little bit in the first two tests. And then the third test comes along and you think, oh, this is India away from home. They don't really play test cricket anymore. They're all about 2020. That's their incentive. That's what they've learned to play, particularly in terms of their batting craft. That's how the narrative sometimes goes around these things. And then suddenly this astonishing low-scoring tussle emerges that has, you know, India's gritted teeth on one side. And then on the other side, in this last innings, South Africa dealing with this pitch that is just, you know, going all over the place, completely breaking up. There are balls that are coming up off a length and kind of knocking people's helmets off. Dean Elgar scores this amazing sort of 80 not out. Hashim Amla, they have to, in the dressing room, they have to desperately create these new gloves for Hashim Amla because he's getting struck on the hand so much that they have to kind of improvise and create these new gloves with sort of extra padding on them. And in the end, India stick at it and manage to get those last South African batsman out and get that actually dead rubber test across the line in their favour. And it's just one of those brilliant games that you do look back on and you say it's got so much sort of drama and intrigue one way or other that one day it'll be worthy of review in from the archives of Reverse Web Radio, which is about as high praise as you can give for a game of cricket, I think.
It's a great example as well of how the whole concept of a dead rubber in a test can often be a nonsense, because India may have lost this series, but they've gone a huge way towards dispelling those accusations of sort of flat track bully and all this sort of stuff. You know, the way they fought in tough, unfamiliar conditions that a lot of their batsmen would have very limited experience of was really, really impressive. I was also completely fascinated, and I think it sounds like, you know, you were able to see more of this than me. I mean, what did you make of this question of how dangerous is too dangerous for a pitch?
So definitely there were balls that were doing unexpected things, and there were batsmen getting hit. I think the issue is always less the in this instance it seemed to be less the actual, you know, danger of are they going to be hit on the head and is something bad going to happen here, and more the question of complete uncertainty that the batsman would have had, and how that gets into their head, and how that then affects the way that they play. Because you know, you can't reliably play forward to anything on a length if you think that it might shoot over your shoulder the next moment. So I don't think, from what I saw of it, and actually I was more following it on Crick Info on the score feed that was coming through than actually watching it. I watched a few of the highlights. There are a few balls that did significant things. It didn't seem like the kind of pitch where suddenly you were thinking this game needs to, you know, desperately be abandoned for anyone's safety per se. And to be honest, it does. I mean, it's difficult to start on this line without sounding like kind of Jeffrey Boycott, but you look back to the days when there were uncovered pitches and pitches would behave unpredictably. You compare that with the days now where pitches are basically pristine and batsman's paradise, and if you're not scoring 500 in the first innings, then it's game over because someone's going to score 600 in the last innings. And you actually think, from time to time, a pitch like this, I think, is actually a really intriguing thing and is a new test to a side and to a side's batting that they just don't have anywhere else anymore.
And you could see from the enthusiasm this series was generating around the world. I mean, particularly in the wake of an Ashes that hadn't quite grabbed the imagination in that way. People see too many batting-friendly pitches. And I think, obviously, the dream is a balance between bat and ball. But if you're not going to get that, actually, watching the bowlers on top is probably more fun. From the archives, and this episode, Toby is going to tell us the tales from his summer out at the cricket.
So as I mentioned in the intro, I've had a kind of cricket-filled summer one way or other, despite the fact that we haven't actually recorded an episode of Reverse Prep Radio since November. So apologies to anyone who's been missing out on our dulcet tones. You were probably better off without us. All of my cricket watching actually happened after Christmas when the England team were here in Sydney for a variety of matches, and I got to see sort of cricket from all sides during that time. I went to the SCG Ashes test, the fifth test of the Ashes. The Ashes was over. England were hoping for a bit of a consolation. Instead, it was what they calculated as being 57 degrees in the middle of the pitch at one point. I was actually there on that day. And England, together with Joe Root's internal organs, sort of went down the pan a bit. For those, I actually went to 2 days of that test, the second and the fourth being the incredibly hot one, for which I was, you know, sitting in the stands with $100 tickets. Actually ended up sitting with the Barmy Army for one of those games, which was an experience and quite fun, but ultimately I have to say pretty frustrating, because not many people around me actually seem to have much interest in watching the cricket, whereas I'm one of those people who wants to follow every ball.
So what was it like? Because that is something I've always been curious. Was it so permanent sing song? What, you know, were people keen for a chat? What sort of thing?
Permanent sing song by about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, certainly. So everyone arrives and everyone's probably a little bit hungover and, you know, just getting started and the beer's not quite flowing. So the first session is relatively quiet. But by the time you get to kind of mid-afternoon session, it's kind of permanent sin song. And I'm actually, you know, it is impressive that the Barmy Army songbook and the range of songs that this massive group of people have and can sing perfectly all the lyrics to, sometimes extending to sort of four or five verses, and some of the lyrics very sort of cleverly put together. There's a feature there actually in the lyrics of Barmy Army songs. So there's that, but then there's also, I mean, certainly on the fourth day of the SCG test, which was fascinating because it was when Joe Root was batting. England needed just to bat and bat and bat, basically, in order to save the test. And Joe Root was out there. It was very slow going. It was hot. The bowling was good. England were really out of the pump, and Joe Root was really knuckling down. And there was this Aussie who was in the stand behind us in one of the corporate who decided to sort of bait the Barmy Army a bit. And the Barmy Army, as one, again, quite an impressive side, rose up to help him. But for about, and I'm not exaggerating it, for about 2 hours, the entirety of the Barmy Army actually stood to the kid
answered this at this guy on the balcony, which was kind of quite different in itself, but it meant if you were sitting there, you couldn't actually watch cricket because there was around a whole group of people kind of standing up around you. So we actually moving into another stand. I mean, it's generally pretty good natured, certainly. Someone who really is at the cricket to watch cricket, it can be a little bit of a frustrating experience at times. That's certainly true. So after 2 days at the SCG, I then, a week or so later, I actually bunked off work for the afternoon. And I went over to a place called Drummoyne, which is a suburb of Sydney. You can get the ferry there from the Opera House. You get the ferry about 20 minutes up the river. And you then cycle for 10 minutes and you're down at this beautiful ground called the Drummoyne Oval, which is effectively a kind of outground, I suppose, in sort of English cricketing parlance, where England were playing a Cricket Australia 11 that I recognised one name on the entire team sheet. And England were kind of out in force. I think this was their chance to warm up before the one day games. Incredibly slow pitch. England absolutely thrashed them. Jody Bairstow was standing on the boundary signing autographs, and it's one of these ones where that you can sort of go right up to the boundary when you're watching the game. It's just a few grass banks around. There's no security or any of that kind of thing. Interesting sight watching Johnny Bairstow actually kind of touting for signatures and autographs on the boundary. He seemed a bit put out that no one was coming and asking him for his autograph. So he'd stand on the balcony and kind of look at kids in the crowd and sort of beckon them towards him and then sign his autographs, which was just a wonderfully different way of doing things than in the tests, where you get the feeling that fielders on the boundary just desperately ignore anything that's going on in the crowd and trying to block out everything that's happened there.
I guess it may be hard for you to tell just sort of from the crowd, but I wonder if at a small venue, did you get any sense of whether the England team was still having fun? Because it was it's such a long, draining winter. And as you made the point with the SCG, they were losing in really kind of exhausting, yep, demoralizing fashion. Did they look like a bunch of players who were still enjoying their tour?
Yeah, they did. And there was actually something about the way that even, when they were running between overs, there just seemed to be a little bit more sort of exuberance around what they were doing and a little bit more, exactly, in a sense of actually enjoying it. I think also the other thing is the pressure is off. The game isn't televised. The crowds are pretty small. They knew they were going to win comfortably. Now, there are a few people for whom the pressure was definitely on. So Moeen, for instance, who obviously had a bit of a shocker in the test series, he came out and actually got out first ball, I think, with the bat. And you kind of thought, now's your moment to really change gear, get into the one day series, score some easy runs on an easy pitch against an easy bowling attack. And you kind of would have thought the pressure was on him. But for others, I think it was much less so in that direction, and I suspect probably a bit of a kind of welcome oasis between the test matches and the one day matches. So like the England team, I went on from the Drummoyne Oval to go and watch some one day cricket. The one day series followed directly after that warm up game, and I and this is my absolute highlight of kind of probably of cricket watching in my life, was actually getting a pass to the members pavilion and the press box at the SCG for the one day game. And actually, the fact is the game was actually a brilliant one. England were really struggling with the bat until about the 40th over, when Jos Buttler scored a century and had a couple of people stay with him, and suddenly we got a good score out of nowhere. That was brilliant to watch. The way that we bowled at Australia, who really should have made that target, was really good to watch as well. But actually, the cricket in a way was sort of secondary just to the amazement of my experience at the way that other people watch cricket. So having been in the stands with the Barmy Army for the test match, where there really is an attitude of how do you schlock in as many people as you possibly can into a smaller space and feed them and drink them in the cheapest and easiest way possible. Suddenly, it's a world apart when you go into the members part of the SCG, and this is the first time I'd been in there. It's things like the fact that you can all of the wheelie bins, the rubbish wheelie bins, actually have these cloth covers over them, as if to say, sort of, you know, people will be offended by the sight of a wheelie bin. We really need to sort of, we really need to tart these up. The other thing that's, that there's a kind of revelatory difference is that in the stands at the SCG, and in fact at all Australian cricket grounds, you can only buy mid-strength beer. Whereas in the pavilion and the members area at the SEG, you can have full strength beer. What a difference that makes to your ability to have a little nap after lunch as wonderful. part of the game.
And I suppose that's widely known, because that's kind of astonishing. Because what you're effectively saying, in no uncertain terms, is that we only trust people of a certain economic clout with the full alcohol. That's a bold statement.
It is absolutely a bold statement. And there's a whole lot of, I mean, the whole thing about the members, and the members area is big. It's not just the pavilion. It incorporates a whole lot of another big stand actually at the SCG. Plus the nets are there. The other thing that's there is the dressing rooms. And what I was really surprised by is the fact that you can actually stand downstairs in the members pavilion at the SCG and watch the players having lunch. And I was kind of bizarrely fascinated, as you are, by what the players are actually eating for lunch. And it seemed like a lot of lettuce, which seemed like an odd decision for me if you had to then go out and play a game of one-day cricket. But you can stand there and you can watch that. The door to the dressing room actually comes off the main bar in the pavilion. So every time someone goes in or out, they open the door and you can see, you know, there's, you know, whoever it is, Adil Rashid getting his calves massaged or whatever it is. So there's a real proximity between the members and the players, and a real sense of everyone being kind of part of that family. The other thing I'd say about the members area at the SCG that kind of interested me is the fact that there's no reserved seating, and the way you reserve your seating is that when you go into the ground, you're given a little piece of paper and you go in and you find the seats that you want to sit in, and obviously the best seats are the ones that are in the shade with a decent view. And you peel off the back of this piece of paper, and it has a sticky back to it, and you write your name on it and you put it on the seat, and that is your seat for the day, which kind of fascinated me as a way of actually kind of reserving your seating, and actually quite a wonderfully democratic way, because what it does is it allows the people who actually get there first to reserve the best seat. So apparently for the test matches, you would have people queuing up from 3 o'clock in the morning to get in. For the one day match where there's less demand, I only tips up at, you know, an hour before the game and got a brilliant seat in the pavilion somewhere.
And that was fully respected. You didn't see anyone challenging
it. It is fully respected, and it's the kind of place where rules, I mean, it kind of reminded me of one of those sort of members clubs in London, the place where everyone is so steeped in the rules that even when you have people who aren't necessarily old timers, they still will absolutely respect the way that the rules happen. Absolutely. So the other part of my day was having this passed to the press box. And this was kind of fascinating in its own right for a whole number of reasons. The first one of which is that when you go into the press box, you basically have a kind of pantheon of cricket greats just doing normal stuff around you. So, you know, you walk past the room and, oh, there's Mark Nicholas, sorry, not necessarily a cricketing great, but certainly a great of the cricketing world. Mark Nicholas having his makeup done. Oh, there's there's Matthew Hayden helping himself to a cup of coffee. I got into a lift, and just as I was to go down back to the ground floor, and as I was going in, this hand came through the lift doors to stop them from closing, and in walked KP and Michael Slater. And they both, you know, smiled at me and asked how I was. And I think that's the nature of when you're in the press box, everyone's very chummy to everyone else. And I said, oh, I'm really well, isn't it a beautiful day, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I then thought to myself, you know, so many times when I was, particularly when I was younger, I thought to myself, what would I say to an international cricketer if I got 2 seconds with him? What's the question that you'd ask? What would you say? Okay, KP, tell me about that moment and blah. And of course, you just get total stage fright. And I was just like a kind of, you know, stupefied child at this point. So there was a lot of just kind of mingling.
It's infuriating, isn't it? Because you feel like we're all sort of fully grown adults now. But I mean, I've not been as lucky and had an experience with KP, but I've had it with sort of famous people where you sort of have that occasion to meet them. And exactly the same, you're completely stuck. And were they curious as to who you were, or did they just accept that this man sharing
no,
their list?
No, because I think there are enough people who are up in the press box, because it's where all of the radio is broadcast out of and all of the TV is broadcast out of. So there are plenty of people who are there to, you know, run the cables and all of that kind of thing. So I don't think they would expect to have been familiar with all of the faces there. The other thing that was interesting is that as part of that complex is, of course, that bit of the press box you see where there are just rows and rows of desks, which the primarily print journalists sit at in order to watch. And of course, that's a brilliant place to watch the cricket from, because it's straight behind the bowler's arm. It's air conditioned, which on a 35 degree Sydney day is a nice thing. The thing that was absolutely amazing, though, was the total silence that there is in that press box. It's like walking into a library, particularly when you've been outside and there's the noise and the banter and the general atmosphere of the crowd. You then go up into the press box and the silence is almost deafening, and that extends to the moment when really remarkable things happen, you know, when there's a brilliant catch or someone gives their wicket away easily. There's no reaction at all in the press box. If you weren't watching the cricket, you wouldn't be able to tell by the reaction of the journalist what's happening, which is obviously not at all the same as when you're in the crowd and you can absolutely tell that things are happening just by listening to the crowd. And the guy actually who was sitting in front of me for a while when I was sitting up there in the press box was just very, very busy reconciling all his receipts for his travel for the summer of following the English team in Australia. I won't name him, that would not be fair. And we'd probably, you know, burn all our bridges with the cricketing community. But I thought that was just a wonderful illustration. For me, it was this, you know, wonderfully exciting opportunity, and for this guy, it was simply the moment when he could reconcile his ledger.
I guess anywhere you work becomes your office, doesn't it? But did it set you off dreaming? Did you look at these people and think, if, you know, maybe I was here, you know, did you feel
no,
like that at all?
No, not for a moment, actually. I actually felt very it's interesting. Do you remember that Miles Jupp book we read a while ago? Fibber in the Heat. He tries to become a cricket journalist and he goes off and he finds it really difficult to kind of get into the sort of social circles, almost, as it were, of cricket journalists. And it's exactly the same. I've never felt so on the outside of a club as you do when you're sitting among that group of people. And I actually thought to myself, where would I rather be? Would I rather be sitting up here in this kind of quite rarefied and exclusive atmosphere, not reacting to anything that's happening on the pitch and just a bit jaded by it all and doing my travel receipts? Or would I rather be down in the crowd, living life down there? And it's absolutely, despite the vagaries of the Barmy Army, being in the crowd is most certainly the thing that I think is for me. So here we are, Andy's halfway through his third beer, and I'm half onto my second pot of coffee, and we're now onto the review. And we've been reading for this episode Woodhouse at the Wicket, which is a volume of writings by the English author P.G. Woodhouse on the of cricket, as the name would suggest. Now, Andy, P.G. Woodhouse is a man very much of his time. Did you find material in this book that you as a cricketer could relate to?
Absolutely, and I think this is the joy of it, is that obviously he's sort of universally revered almost as, you know, one of the great British comic authors. But what's fun is having such a great comic author at work who also is clearly a complete cricket nut. So all this writing is infused both with great comedy but also a really, really in-depth knowledge of the game.
One of the things that struck me is when you, particularly when he's talking about sort of amateur games, and he describes particular kinds of cricketers, you can absolutely recognise that in the kind of cricket that I play here at Moore Park and you play at Pinkney's Green. There's the wonderful description of the lob bowler that he comes up with, and he spends quite a while describing this guy. He describes lobs as the most dangerous insinuating things in the world. Everybody knows in theory the right way to treat them. Everybody knows that the man who is content not to try to score more than a single cannot get out to them, yet nearly everybody does get out to them. And that is something that is actually played out in amateur cricket fields around the world day in, day out. And the joy of this book is the fact that P.G. Woodhouse, in the beauty of his comedic writing, conveys this in a way that is just gets straight to the heart of the matter, I think.
Yeah, and as with any collection, it's a bit of sort of odds and sods. We get sort of all sorts. There's a fair bit of fiction in here. We've got these Mike Jackson stories that the book kicks off with. And these are kind of good, to some extent, they're good old-fashioned tales of slightly improbable sporting heroics. You know, it's the kind of stuff that teenage boys love. But the thing is, Woodhouse is obviously too good just to write simple, feel-good tales like that. And he shows a great grasp of the humour in almost every situation. I love this description of being out of form. So Mike was oppressed by that leaden sense of inferiority which weighs on a man who has turned up to dinner in ordinary clothes when everybody else has dressed. I just thought it's both spot on and sort of perfect humour. There's a surprising amount of romance in these books. Several stories where cricket plays a great role, and you've also got that old Woodhouse ability to conjure sort of farce out of any situation.
Well, and again, it's something that keys into, and it's put in, you know, in Woodhouse's hands, it is in a particular style and it's in a particular age, but again, it's something that rings true now. When we were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, darting back to the UK every other necessarily in the summer, given that your stay with you. And a lot of those romance books are actually about that conflict that people between different, and yet the girl that they love either doesn't like cricket or wants them to be doing something else. And the way that they sort of muddle their way through that is really kind of quite fun. There is always the kind of safety of these stories that you always know that there is one way or other going to be the happy ending. I love the story about the guy who's a cricket, you know, nuts, and he decides to woo a woman with the only quotation from poetry that he knows, at which point she responds and goes, oh, you love poetry, so do I. And he goes, thinks, oh god, I'm gonna have to go off and learn all this poetry. He does that. They build their relationship based on this. Eventually he misses a date because he's playing cricket. It comes out that he's been playing cricket, and she says, oh, you're a cricket fan, that's brilliant, does that mean that you don't like poetry? And he said, oh no, I've always hated it, I just made up that I liked it. And she said, oh god, so did I, and the number of hours that I spent too learning poetry all the way, and you know, all along the way. So the moral of that story, which is that clearly everyone loves cricket, is one that I can get on board with, but the way that the stories are constructed is really beautiful within that, I think.
Yes, that story, yes, Reginald's Record Knock, also involves probably my favourite ever club team name. They're called the Hearty Lunchers, which is a rather splendid name. We also get some non-fiction as well here, which is a real pleasure. There's an essay near the end just called Now Talking About Cricket, which is kind of the only time in the collection which is basically Woodhouse just unleashing on cricket. And it's a real pleasure. It's rambling in the way that only a very good writer can get away with, because he kind of moves from topic to topic, and you can't from the outside almost discern a clear order. But it's fun, and as a result, you're very happy to stick with it.
I was just going to say that there's also an enormous range of reference that he brings into that. I remember suddenly, you know, realizing that he was talking about Greek tragedy. I think it was Agamemnon at some point. And the way that he's able to distill this enormous world of knowledge that he has down onto the game of cricket. He clearly sees cricket as a kind of palette for so much more in life and culture that can be brought together. And that's one of the things that actually I think makes this book a really enjoyable read. To go back to that old C.L.R. James quotation about those who, you know, you need to basically saying you need to know more about, to know cricket, you need to know more than cricket. And this is really writ large in this book, I think.
And we get, as a sort of final part of the book, we get this match report of Dulwich versus St. Paul's, which is made somewhat poignant by the fact that it was July 1939. So, you know, schoolboy cricket was very soon to become, more poignant than ever. But it's sort of a particular pleasure to see that actually, for a writer of so many tricks and fun, he can actually write a very good, very punchy match report. And although he can't quite give it up fully, describing the game as probably the dreariest ever seen on the school grounds. So as a writer who couldn't quite ever do sort of, completely po-faced.
Mm-mm. So that is Woodhouse at the Wicket. Writings on cricket by P.G. Woodhouse, edited by Murray Hedgecock. It's published by Random House, Arrow Books and Random House. And I'm sure it's available from all good bookstores, etc., etc., etc. And that was the 90-something, 98th episode of Reverse Web Radio, coming to you from Paris and Sydney. We'll try and not make it such a hiatus before the next episode, now that we're into the rhythm of the year, as we hope you all are. If you've loved it or hated it or have anything to say, please do head over to iTunes and leave us a review there. You can also find us, as ever, on Twitter at Reverse Swept, and we'll look forward to talking again soon.